Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Imagine covering the White House as a reporter for a media outlet. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? Unless you're claustrophobic, think of very small cubicles. On the plus side, you're witnessing history. And my guest has reported on a lot of history. Stephen L. Herman is author of Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters. And it's published by Kent State University Press. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. Stephen L. Herman's long career in journalism includes covering the White House for Voice of America during the Trump administration and the first 8 months of the Biden administration. For everything about Steve, go to steveherman.press. And Steve, welcome back to the show.
It is a pleasure to be back, Ira, after a few years.
It is. For those who may not know about Voice of America, and I find it hard to believe that there are people, but there are, just the nature of everything these days. Can you explain what Voice of America is first, and then we'll get into the book?
Sure. It's no surprise that many Americans would not know the Voice of America because it is an external broadcasting service. We broadcast radio, television, on the web, social media from the United States to other countries. We have 48 language services, including English and learning English. And we specifically focus on countries that don't have a free press or are not well developed with a free press. And it is 100% part of the U.S. government. But there is a firewall between the folks, reporters at my level, and the bosses in any particular administration.
It just seems unusual, and I want to get into the book, but that you are technically working for the government, but at the same time, you're covering part of the government, in this case, the White House. So that seems, it's almost an official body as covering an official body.
Well, we are under an independent agency, and as I said, the people in any particular administration, the State Department, or wherever, cannot pressure us to do stories favorable to the president or against a political candidate. We take that very, very seriously.
Now, you started this book when? About 2 years ago?
Well, I wrote elements of it over a number of years. Some of the chapters, for example, dealing with Fukushima disaster in Japan and the whole UFO thing in Roswell, New Mexico. I had drafts of those chapters some years ago and wasn't sure what I was going to do with them. And I vowed, Ira, near the end of the Trump administration, when we had dozens of correspondents sitting in the press briefing room working on their books about the Trump administration, that I was not going to write a book. But a lot of people just said to me, oh, you should write a book. And what I realized, there wasn't really a book that explains the mechanics of what it's like to cover a White House and the historical relationship between the press and the presidents goes all the way back to George Washington's second term, where he was mad at the press and the press was calling him a traitor and feeble and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of the things that we're experiencing now are nothing new. And I wanted to demonstrate that in the book.
I want to quote from your book. Quote, working inside the White House as a reporter and frequently traveling with the president, I sought to provide accurate, objective, and comprehensive reporting on the presidency. End quote. It's a tall order because the media or the press these days is viewed as subjective rather than objective. I know that in your case, you want to be objective, and I've known you for a long time, and you are objective, but there are elements of the press that some view as too left and others as perhaps too right. And it's that herd mentality that seems to creep into a short space in the briefing room where everybody seems to just report the same take on a president's statements or the press secretary's statements.
Yes, I like to say that VOA may be the only news organization in the world that's mandated by law to be objective. That's in our charter. This is something Congress has literally passed in the law. And also, our audience is not a domestic U.S. audience. We are compelled to explain what's going on in the United States, and that means interviewing people from both sides of the issue. And even though there may be a Republican or Democrat in the White House at any particular time, we cannot just take a partisan line in our reporting, although that upsets some administrations.
What your colleagues think of you in the sense of you're coming from an objective standpoint or what you strive to be in terms of your reporting, and your colleagues may come from other viewpoints. So do they look at you as a little bit of an anomaly, or that you represent what really journalism should be?
I think in recent decades, they are very clearly able to see what we're reporting and how we're reporting it, because now everything's up on the web, right? You can go look at the reports, where in decades past, your reports were going out on shortwave radio primarily and being translated into different languages. So they didn't really have an idea of what you were reporting. But VOA is part of the White House press pool, and I go into great detail about that in the book. And they're able to see how we're reporting, how we're acting, and we're doing a job on behalf of all of the rest of the media when you're part of the pool. So even though you may have, in the case of particular broadcast networks or print outlets, a certain political bent, when they're doing the pool reporting, it's very straightforward. You're not really putting a spin on what you're giving to all the rest of the press to distribute to all of their outlets. You're serving everything from left-wing to right-wing media when you're in the pool. So I don't think this is a real issue these days. And if anything, they probably regard VOA as being very much in the middle.
You mentioned, and you get into quite a description of what a pool is. So for those, again, listeners and viewers who may not know what a pool report is, why don't you just share that with us?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with water or swimming, Ira, although where we operate from, our desk used to be the John Kennedy's swimming pool. The pool, you could call it a sort of a collective, in the sense that if there's something happening in the Oval Office or in Air Force One, obviously 100 reporters can't fly on Air Force One.
Although they would love to.
100 reporters, yeah, can't go into the Oval Office.
So although they would like to.
Yeah, I'm sure they would like to. We have to decide for the broadcasters and for the newspapers and the photographers and the TV networks, there's a designated entity every single day as to who is on call if there are one of these limited events, say, taking place in the Oval Office or on Air Force One or the Roosevelt Room, Cabinet Room, whatever. So that's what a pool reporter does. They go in and they're there representing all of the entities in that particular pool from their type of media. So when I go in to the Oval Office with a microphone and a digital recorder, I'm recording on behalf of CBS Radio, AP Radio, BBC, et cetera. And so we take turns every day. And so for the radio pool, somebody from VOA would generally be in the in-town pool once every 10 days or less. And then there's the travel pool, which has a smaller number of outlets because some don't want to travel because of the cost involved. We do not ride free on Air Force One. Our news organizations are charged for that seat. So some news organizations, it's just cost prohibitive for them to be part of the travel pool, especially when it's an overseas trip and the cost can go into the tens of thousands of dollars. I think there was an Obama trip where the individual charge per person for a news organization was somewhere around $90,000. It was a trip to Asia.
Ooh. Does the White House or the press office have any say in who represents the pool on a given day? Can they decline someone from participating at the pool?
No, is the short answer. Although in doing the research for my book, I was able to find out that President Lyndon Johnson, for example, kicked certain news organizations off of Air Force One for a particular period. But in recent years, that has not happened, although the White House press office has gone after certain individual reporters and taken away what's called the hard pass, which is a credential that lets you get in without an escort into the press areas of the White House. And those reporters have gone to court, and generally it's been upheld. Their hard passes have been reinstated.
Mm-hmm. So it comes across as a little petty from the White House staff who may be doing that.
Right. Now, I should explain that to get a pass to get into the White House, there is vetting, mainly by the Secret Service. They do background checks and whatnot. And the White House press office can decide whether you get an appointment pass, which means you have to have an escort and you know, register every day or every week, versus the hard pass, which is more of a one-year semi-permanent pass. So there is that aspect. But then if you notice in the press briefing room, there's 49 seats. So obviously there are hundreds and hundreds of news organizations that are credentialed for the White House, but there's only seats for, actually it's less than 49 organizations, because some of them are shared seats. That doesn't mean they sit in the same seat at the same time. They take turns on certain days. That is not controlled by the White House press office. Who sits in those seats is up to the White House Correspondents Association, and they determine who's going to be in the first row and who's going to be in the back row. And obviously, the top TV networks and the wire services, AP and Reuters, would be in the front row. And if your organization is showing up every day for months or years covering the White House, then you're more apt to be assigned one of those seats.
Does the White House Correspondents Association go to bat for any of its members if there's a perceived slight by not recognizing the reporter for questions or some other situation?
They will, in general, if there's a particular issue, try to resolve it behind the scenes. But on occasion, the White House Correspondents Association will issue a public statement. It deals with more general access for the pool and things like that. But there have been issues. And sometimes they have to admonish some of the reporters who may be in the press briefing room not to yell out questions and let other people talk if they're called upon. Usually these are those who are not members of the Correspondents Association. I like to say, Ira, it's easier to get a press pass for the White House than perhaps the Boulder City Fire Department, because they generally lean on a side of inclusiveness. But that has attracted over the decades, and I go into some of this in the book, what we would call gadfly reporters. And there's always been a colorful cast of these fringe journalists, if you even want to call some of them that, who have gotten access to the White House briefing room and stand on the side, raise their hand, and once in a while do get called on. So that there's some of that in the book as well.
And I should tell our listeners and viewers that the reference to Boulder City is because Steve spent a lot of time in Nevada. He's very well known in Nevada and Las Vegas in particular. And I've enjoyed reading in your book about, I may be one of those few people that understand some of that stuff, but you're talking about how you're hooking up the XLR to the digital recorder and what's required with the shotgun mic and all that stuff, which I think a lot of people would get a kick out of. They don't know how the mundane technology works when you're covering the White House.
Right. And that's also something that most people don't know, is you can be, as a pool reporter, sitting around for hours or the entire day with nothing happening. And that gives you time, of course, to work on your own stories. And then all of a sudden you get a call over the loudspeakers for the pool to assemble, and you don't know what's going to happen. And then 5 minutes later, you're in the Oval Office and the president is making some major announcements. So you have to be ready at all times. You're in a standby mode, and then something can happen very, very quickly. It is a both a boring job sometimes and a very tough and thrilling job.
Well, the analogy again is the fire department, maybe the one in Boulder City where you sit around right. until all of a sudden there's a fire. And then everybody.
Well, we don't slide down poles in the White House, though, but we do have to come up from the basement sometimes.
Yeah. You write in the book about your early years, and I got a kick out of it, too, because I was in a similar situation. That's probably why I laughed at it or enjoyed it. But when you're locally based in a city and you can feed reports to networks, and Las Vegas is a wonderful place for this because there's so many things that go on here and of national interest. And you become not only working, if you work at a local radio station, you might get paid a pittance, but you also supplement that income with audio reports to various networks. And do you still, now I have to fast forward all these decades later, the seasoned mature reporter, Stephen L. Herman, do you still get a kick out of doing reports?
Well, I do them exclusively, the voice reports or TV reports for the Voice of America because I'm a staffer for VOA.
Right, but you get a kick out of it, though.
Oh, absolutely. And radio is my first love, Ira. I still like doing radio more than television. But what you're referring to, the what we call stringing for the networks, Las Vegas, 1970s, 1980s, early 1980s, when I was starting out doing this, there was always something happening in town, and the networks loved the exotica of Las Vegas because they thought, of course, you know, it's Sin City with the gambling, and there's all sorts of wild things happening there. So we would circulate the reports or tape of an event, and it was actually under a guy named Bill Buckmaster at KORK Radio that I learned all about it. He's been in the Tucson market for many decades now. And we call that dialing for dollars.
And in those days, to go down memory lane here, you would use the phone line and you would send that audio through the phone line. And then
yes, but there was a way to get slightly better audio quality. You would unscrew the mouthpiece of your phone.
Well, now you're going way back in time.
Yes. Use alligator clips and then talk through a feed tape through a tape recorder.
Exactly.
So, yeah, because that was generally how 99% of the better quality audio reports were doing. There were other tricks too.
Yeah, pre-digital age. So, well, one of the things you talk about in your book, and there's a lot of material in the book, but one of the things you talk about, which is important, and I wanted to bring it up, is from your point of view and from the Voice of America's point of view, it's accuracy over speed.
Absolutely. We are very, very careful to make sure that what we're reporting is accurate. Now, no news organization, including the VOA, is perfect. That has 100% record. And if we get something wrong, we will certainly correct it as quickly as possible. But what we want to make sure, and this has been the tradition for decades, if somebody in China or Zimbabwe is hearing a report on the Voice of America, as opposed to something else they may be hearing from their own domestic media or picking up on the internet these days, they can be assured if it's on VOA, it's accurate. And so sometimes we're not the first to report it, but we're going to report it accurately.
I like what you said about if you find a problem or error, you correct it. Do you think that most TV networks and radio networks should have as newspapers tend to do, have a correction column where they could admit that there was a problem or retract something?
I think these days, the only sort of on-air corrections you would hear is if somebody went to court and sued or there was a settlement which said you must retract or correct the story on the air. It's generally not done because they don't want to, or that everything is so fluid in TV and radio and it sort of goes by. Or, you know, in some cases, maybe they change the script in, you know, the next hours or something like that. But you're right. Rarely do they sort of refer to an hour ago, you know, we messed up and got this wrong. It does happen, but it's pretty darn rare in my experience.
And I think, too, that that's part of where journalism sometimes slips in the public mind, because when not with you, but with say a television network reporting on a story and there's something is awfully wrong with the story, they don't come out and say, hey, we want to retract that. They may issue a small little mention of it in some subsequent newscast, but it's not at the level what newspapers used to do, where they'd have a retraction or a correction box and they would say, hey, this we want to correct this because this isn't right.
Yeah, I think the flip side of that is probably more egregious errors in being a responsible news outlet in what's not being reported. Guilt by omission rather than commission. And that's something that we are a counter to internationally, because if you have broadcasters who are state-owned or state-sponsored in countries such as Russia, in China, Iran, and other places, some of what they're reporting may be accurate, but a lot of times it's what they're not reporting, especially about their own country.
Yeah. To quote you from your book, you said, throughout many presidential administrations, reporters assigned to the West Wing ground level or below complained about being treated like mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed manure, end quote. Does that feeling still go on?
Oh, I think that's true in any administration, especially if you don't have access to the president on a regular basis, and you're just relying on what is coming in a readout or what the press secretary is saying from the podium, and the press secretary deflects, you know, the questions, it gets very, very frustrating. So a lot of the really great reporting that occurs about the White House or the presidency is going to take place by reporters who are not working in the White House, because they're going to have the time to devote to that, where if you're in the White House, you're really focused on the deluge of information that's coming through every single day.
What was the biggest challenge for you during your time in the White House? You served the VOA in that capacity as a reporter in the White House. What was the most challenging time for you there?
Well, I think because I was there primarily for the Trump administration, there were a lot of times when the sort of set agenda for the day. So, for example, Infrastructure Week was always a popular event on the agenda. And then something that would sort of blow up the agenda. And I know that was frustrating for those White House press officers and advisors, too, because they may have wanted to focus on an issue. So if you had prepared for, quote unquote, Infrastructure Week to do a story about electric vehicles or something like that, and then the president says something on a completely different subject, maybe about China, that becomes huge news, you have to pivot very quickly. And so we did not get around to some of those big Infrastructure Week stories. So that's kind of frustrating. And I think it got to the point where I finally told the editors, because you have morning editorial meetings, you're trying to set the day, let our news, our different language services know what's going to be coming through. And I used to tell them, don't even ask me what I'm going to be reporting until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because there's something's going to happen that right. is going to come out of the blue, and I'll have to pivot very, very quickly. So there was a lot of that.
Do you get responses or emails from either fans in other countries or governments, other governments, about some of your reporting over the years? From the White House?
Well, yes, we do, of course. But as you know, usually you get more, if you want to call it, fan mail from individuals or governments if they're taking issue with something that you've reported, thinking that it's been unfair, or they just perhaps want to put some pressure on you. So, the Trump administration especially was obviously a very divisive time in our country. And so this can be true in the current administration, too, where people, if you're not taking their view on how they think you should be reporting about a particular president or administration, they may write to you or send an email and complain about it, accusing you of being unfair. That's what's known in the business as confirmation bias. People only selecting news sources that agree with their particular point of view, where, of course, what we should be doing in any democracy is it's trying to source out different types of information, and you can figure out what is credible or not credible after a while. That is what is called media literacy, right? Where you can discern between some crazy thing somebody sent you on Facebook versus, say, a well-researched story in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times.
Do you have a challenge in the Voice of America? Because you're from the old school, which is, again, your objective journalism. The Voice of America wants to do objective reporting. You have a lot of students that are in journalism schools today that are, I'll use the quote-unquote woke variety, where they come from a certain perspective. How does that clash with what the culture of the VOA is, in the sense of you have to emphasize to people joining the agency to be objective? And is there a set way they do that, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ira. I am, for the past maybe a couple of years, I've been teaching journalism classes at universities, and we try to take them through the basics. And obviously, there is a segment of journalism that we could call activism journalism, right? If you're going to work for a particular NGO or a political campaign, they may have people that are doing a job very similar to what we do as a journalist, but they're trying to get through a particular point of view. So what I tell people in journalism schools is, look, we're going to tell you what it should be like in mainstream journalism, what it's been like traditionally. These sort of skill sets that you will learn in school, even if you go into public relations or work for a politician or an NGO, these are, you know, basic skills that you know about and can use, and you'll be aware of when maybe you're being used, and you have to decide whether you're comfortable with that approach or not. But it's obvious that a lot of young people are disenfranchised, have tuned out the mainstream media, and there are older folks like that as well, as I said, that just want to hear things parroted back to them that they believe. So it's not just young people.
Yeah, the silo effect. But has the agency thought about that in terms of how they can sit down with new entries into the organization to let them know you want to practice objective journalism because of the mission of the agency?
Well, I would say those journalists coming into the Voice of America are usually not beginners. They've worked somewhere else. And so, for example, our Swahili service or our Korean service, they're coming in with some sort of journalistic experience. And they will go through a series of mandatory classes that we have that cover objectivity, that cover bias, all sorts of things that, you know, any good journalist should know.
Before I let you go, what's the most surprising thing you discovered when you wrote this book?
Well, that I could write a book, I guess, or a book of this length. When I found out, as I said at the beginning, that this tension between the press and presidents goes all the way back to George Washington, and this is nothing new, and most presidents have had issues with the press, and most presidents have at some point or another gotten a hard time from the media, and there's been media frustration with probably almost every president, except, you know, those who weren't in office for very long.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Stephen L. Herman. He's author of Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist story of covering the president. and Why It Matters. It's published by Kent State University Press, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for more about Stephen L. Herman, go to steveherman.press. And Steve, thanks for being on the show again.
It's been my pleasure, Ira.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.